Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 45.
55.
That's some pretty good Dutch. So this week we did my favorite thing we do every summer, which is go and see the Circus Smirkus tour. This year we went to Northampton, Massachusetts, which is right outside Springfield. And the theme was Midnight at the Museum, sort of like that Ben Stiller movie where everybody goes to sleep and then middle of the night the museum comes alive. And that's where you see some of the really great circus acts.
Directed by Mark Lonergan.
Who's also directing this year's Big Apple. Yep. And also Troy Wonderly, who is the creative director for Smirkus now for like a decade. Mm-hmm.
Troy wore very tight pants.
They look great on him.
They look great. His legs look so string beany and long. And it's like so perfect for a clown.
I mean, I thought this year's show was excellent. Like the troupe was so good. It's also really interesting to see like generationally what things are stronger versus weaker. And the girls, man, the girls these days. The girls last year they were amazing, really. And this year they were even more amazing.
Yeah, there was like a girl. What's her name? Oh, Chaya Potter. She was a bass. And, like, so solid, so strong.
She based a three high, I think,
yeah,
right?
Based a three high with the two Zuckerman twins, who I always enjoy watching every year.
Yeah, whatever they're drinking in Seattle at Sanka, the circus school there, is some good circus water. All four of the kids who are from Sanka were fantastic.
The whole show was really good, so it's hard to pick my favorites, but the contortion act was, like, incredible.
They're so good.
They're so good. I mean, forgive us if we're wrong, but I'm because they were wearing unitards with full covered heads, so it's hard to see exactly who it was. But I'm pretty sure it was Lola Picayo, Safi Watson, who's a first year trooper, and Elsa Bryan and Eva Lou Rhinelander, and they were so good.
Yeah, I think it was the best contortion act, you know, since back in my days in 2007 when we had two imported Mongolian contortionists named Innie and Gigi. No, Innie was one of their names. It's hard to remember Mongolian names, but the contortion act was like really strong. These girls are super flexible. Sort of reminded you of like this Curious style fast.
The one in this year's.
This year's, yeah. This year's was similar to the Cirque du Soleil Curious act in just some of the positions they made and the speed at which they were moving.
And Ben Schiffer's wife, Rebecca Starr, she was the coach for these girls and helped create the act. It was a really good act. My other favorite was Chinese Pole.
That was a great note. I mean, Chinese Pole is always good.
Love Chinese Pole.
But they had a trooper from Zambia whose name is Patrick, who really just threw some crazy, crazy drops.
Oh, just like insane drops. Just insane drops. I was like, oh my God. And I guess, you know, he's just so powerful. And I mean, he was doing these tricks that the dudes in Limbo that we saw in Australia were throwing. And I was like, this kid is 18. Where did you come from?
Zambia is where he came from. I also thought Ben Kaufman, who did this hilarious Beethoven impression, was just so funny. I mean, the clowns are always good at Smirkus. And, you know, sometimes the acrobats also get comedy moments, but Ben Kaufman was just super, super hilarious. Also, speaking of acrobats who got some comedy moments, Sarah Norden, who's from Maine, was super funny and super good aerialist in general. Mm-hmm. I think she's going to ENC next year, but she was definitely a highlight.
Sam
Landa, man, he was great last year. I think we talked about him, but super strong, super flexible, sort of that Brett Pfister, Seb Kahn mold, also going to ENC, I believe.
And then this year, for the first time ever, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was singing. There was singing in the...
I mean, I can't say for sure first time ever, but it first time I remember seeing singing.
Laska and Alexa did a little singing moment. I'm pretty sure it was Alexa. Again, I'm really, really apologetic if I'm wrong, but I think it was Alexa and Laska. And they did this little singing. I'm a sucker for musicals, so I was like, yes, Mark Lonergan, put that song in there.
Yeah, and if we didn't mention your name, don't feel bad. Like, I was the trooper who never would have gotten mentioned, so, you know, I identify with you. But it was really strong tour this year. Really great job the kids did. Super awesome to see it. Can't wait to see where some of these kids are headed.
It's really fun to watch everyone grow and progress and make an amazing show that is better than, I don't know, half the shows we see. So congratulations to you all. It was amazing.
Speaking of better shows than what we usually see.
Our show.
Misbehave Game Show going on in Las Vegas right now. I think the official opening is sometime next week, but how's it going, Linz?
It's going well. We haven't gotten any of the official press reviews out yet because those are most likely embargoed until a certain date.
Would you explain that for people what happens with press?
I don't know if this is what it is everywhere, but especially in New York, if you have a show, the press comes before opening night to review the show. Normally, like in olden days, the press would come on opening night and all the reviews, everyone would stay up and put out the paper the next day. But now with,
The internet
and being able to write quicker and all this stuff, they go prior to opening night. Because also there's so many more shows that it's hard to have only one night available to press to go see. So it's usually three press nights and they happen a week before opening. But because it's before official opening night, the press is embargoed and are not allowed to release their review until a certain moment on opening night.
So that everybody gets to release it at the same time.
Right. Because that was the other thing. If you got to see the show first, you could theoretically put your review out first, and then that would maybe be the more important review. But with reviews, no one really reads them. Some people read them. Some reviews matter, some don't. But anyway, it's this big old
thing. But we do like to read them when they're good reviews.
We do and sometimes when they're really bad.
But Misbehave has been getting some good ones.
Misbehave has been getting really good ones. So these are, I don't know if they're amateur reviewers, but just not
the official press outlets.
Not the official press outlets. In VitalVegas.com, the title is Misbehave Game Show is a Bawdy, Boisterous Bash at Bally's.
It's good alliteration.
It is. And one of my favorite quotes from the article is, "The Misbehave Game Show is a cheeky, subversive, and sexy breath of fresh air and well worth a look during your next Las Vegas visit."
Yes, it is.
In Vegas for Visitors, Vegas for the number, visitors.com, they gave us a rating of an A.
Woo!
Woohoo! And they said it's an outrageous, wildly inventive mixture of a game show, variety show, and improv comedy show. And what's really cool about the show is you could go five times and see different variety performers, because what's awesome is there's two slots for variety performers who happen to be in Vegas or are coming in to do the show. And this past few weeks have been Monkey, who's an amazing burlesque kind of, I don't know, performer. Right? Burlesque, is that maybe?
Yeah, burlesque comedy
skill.
He's met many talents. Yes.
And Marowa,
the amazing.
Marowa the Amazing, who is a really fun hula hooper. So again, you could see them and then you go back in a month and you see a different performer. So I think it's a really cool show. So if you're in Vegas, if you live there, if you're visiting, make sure to go see Misbehave Game Show at Bally's.
You can get tickets at misbehavegameshow.com.
And we're working on one other little project right now, right, Josh?
Just one other little project?
Well, I guess just not one, but what? There's a one with virtual reality.
Yeah, so I wanted to give everybody sort of an update on our virtual reality Kickstarter. Back in October and November of last year, Linz and I fundraised successfully with about 150 backers to do this brand new circus virtual reality experience. The only other people in the game doing anything with sort of 360 media, it seems like, is Cirque du Soleil, who are doing something pretty different from what we're doing. And I'm a little nervous to give too many of the details away online because I really feel like our idea is super novel and I want to be the first people to put it out there. I don't want anybody to take it, but it's been going really, really well. Last month we shot this cool juggling video with Book Kennison. In the next couple of months, we're going to go shoot a duo cereal act in Kansas City. But basically we're going around the country shooting these super good, high quality circus acts with this 360 camera. And placing them in the middle of these beautiful, beautiful locations. And then we also have sort of this interactive, immersive element, which ties the whole thing together and gives the user a little bit of choice. And it's different, like Misbehave Game Show, every time you put on the VR headset. And that's taken us a little longer than we were anticipating to make, because it requires a lot of coding, which, my background is circus casting and circus performing and then learning how to produce and direct things. So I've been teaching myself a little bit of code, and we have some friends who are helping us out with that, but it's created a little bit of a delay. But I think it's going to be worth it, because I would rather everybody have something that is truly unique and memorable and like really leaves you with a great impression than something we just put out quickly.
So you'll get it eventually.
Eventually. Well, I think my goal originally had been to get it out before our wedding
next week.
Oh my God.
Which just isn't going to happen. I'm sorry, everybody. But I'm hoping to have it out by September or November, latest December. So if you're a Kickstarter backer, you'll see it by then. Otherwise, we'll be submitting it to various film festivals that have these like VR exhibits in them. So you'll have to go to one of those if you want to see it. And then eventually, maybe sometime in the spring, it'll be open for our non-backers to watch and experience and download in the iTunes store or in the Google Play store. But I'm so excited to share with everybody. But I'm really glad to see that, you know, Cirque du Soleil is not making what we're making. So we're going to be the first people out of the gate with a truly immersive, original circus VR concept. We do still have a slot available for an American circus performer. So if you're in town and you want to be in our VR experience, shoot me an email. hello@hideawaycircus.com. We're looking for ground acts. We have basically everything we need booked. But, you know, I'm still open to adding one more number to it. Got to be super high skill, got to work well in 360, and you got to know a beautiful location somewhere in America we can go and shoot it. So shoot me that email, hello@hideawaycircus.com.
One other thing that I was just thinking about, going back to Smirkus for a minute, yeah. And all these really amazing high skill level, great performers. I think that an important part of what we're doing with this podcast is educating on all the various different venues and like ways in which you can become part of the circus. It's not just going to ENC or the Montreal School or the Quebec School, but, you know, like all the different schools. Like, we interviewed Corey from Circus Maine and NECA, and there's schools all over the country that you can really get a good education at. And also, what's important to remember is you can also be on the backside of a circus show. So, which is why I'm super excited that we have Nat Brown on our podcast today. Because I think as a performer in theater, also you only are ever taught that the only avenue into theater is being a performer. But there's so many other jobs that are just as important and fun and rewarding. And Nat Brown is an amazing example of something that you can do that's still a massive part of the show, but not a performer.
When I was in university, I wrote my graduate thesis on touring with tents and sort of some of the challenges. So they've been bumping around in my head for a while. And Nat Brown, I would say, is the expert on circus tents and what it takes to put them up, to tour with them, to fix them, to buy them. Literally, you got a question about how you use a tent, circus tent, Nat Brown is your man. I think this is going to be like one of the most interesting interviews. You know, we do a lot of stuff with circus artists that I'm sure might sound similar. Story of going to ENC, story of getting your first job, how that escalates. And this is truly like no other interview we've had. Nat tells us about how he got doing tent crews, some of the amazing stories of putting up these big tents and things that have gone wrong, what's going on with tented touring shows in the U.S. So you're in for a real treat.
I also love that his title is Tent Boss.
Nat Brown, Tent Boss.
And we did do this interview at Smirkus in the back lot of Smirkus. So there is a little background noise because we are sitting on the tables right by the food truck. The pie car. Sorry. Excuse me. Use correct terms, Lindsay. But I think this is a really great episode. And again, congratulations to everyone involved in Smirkus, from the board to the people who came to see the show, to the performers, to everyone. It was really good.
Really strong 30th anniversary performance.
Yes.
But before we let you listen to our awesome interview with Nat Brown, please like us on Facebook, Twitter tweet us, follow us on Instagram, email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com, and please, please, please rate us on iTunes. We are now on the arts charts in 4 different countries, and that's because of the ratings we get from you guys. So the more you rate us, the more people listen to us. So we really, really appreciate it. We do this podcast for free, so if you want to give back to us, that's really the best way to do it.
Enjoy our interview with Nat Brown, Tent Boss.
Nat, where did you grow up?
Wellesley, Massachusetts.
You're a Massachusetts boy.
Yep. Yeah, born and raised. I love it. It's nice to come back here right now and see all the jerks.
Yeah, we're recording this at Circus Mercus in Northampton, right at the, what would you call this tent we're sitting under?
We call it the dining dink, actually, affectionately, actually. But yeah, it's a little 16 by 20 tent. And it's, yeah, one of the few upgrades we've made in the last few years to our kit.
So. To this Mercus kit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was the first tented show you saw?
The first tented show I saw was when I was in second grade, and it was Big Apple Circus in Boston. So
I remember. Is it their white or their blue tent or their old, old tent?
It was their old, old tent. Yeah, it was before they upgraded. So I had my first communion and I got to pick where I wanted to go for a party and I chose the circus. And when I went there, I spent the most of the time not really watching the acts, but looking at all the tent and the gear and everything. And I just couldn't understand how it had been a parking lot, you know, the week before. And now it was like the city. So I remember being really like struck by that and it just kind of sat with me, and then it was like a memory in the back of my head for a long time. So, yeah.
When did it start to be more than like a memory and be something that you were actually like researching and learning and teaching yourself about?
Totally by accident, like most things. But my little brother, Sam Brown, who's a clown here at Smirkus, called me up one day. I was working like three jobs doing construction and bussing tables and just working my butt off in the summer. And, they needed someone for ring crew, and so I jumped in for the rest of the summer and got a taste of the life. And when I came onto the lot, the first thing I saw was them unfolding the canvas. And so I hopped in right out of the car and helped unroll it and connect all the straps. And it was kind of this moment where I thought, you know, this isn't normal, this is magical. And the next year I came back on tent crew, and over the years it just kind of became this thing that it became more real, and it became something that I thought that, you know, I could make a living doing it and it could be a career. It wasn't just a summer gig, you know, at a certain point. And I guess that was when probably five or six years into doing Smirkus, I got a call from a friend who's working at Big Apple, and they needed someone for tent crew. And I was in college correcting papers as a TA, and they're just horrible papers. Like, people were not trying at all. And I thought, you know, I wanted something different. And so I hopped on with Big Apple. And I think that was the point when I thought I could actually make a career out of it. And
so you went to college.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go to school?
UMass Amherst.
You went to UMass? I'm from Boston.
Nice.
So, like, so many people went to UMass,
oh,
which
yeah.
is why I didn't. Like, I'm not going. So what did you study?
I started out with psychology. Which, you know, was interesting, and I was in an accelerated program, so I got a real fast taste of what it would be if I went into the field, and I hated it. So I quickly changed my major to a self-design major, which was kind of a silly one looking back on it, but I mean, it was college, so it was human relations is what I titled it, and it's basically an amalgamation of anthropology, communication studies, you know, basically all the interesting classes I wanted to take,
right.
I got thrown in there. So.
And so you finished school?
Yeah, mostly, no.
And now you use that psychology.
I have like six credits left, so I stepped away when I went to Big Apple, and so I was kind of burned out, and so I still intend on going back, but at this point in my life, I think I'm going to get that, you know, arts degree, you know, done, and then I want to go back for engineering, actually.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
I bet you that's helpful for tents in general.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to lay out for people sort of two main topics for people who know very little about circus tents.
Mm-hmm.
Part one of the question is, can you describe, like, what the general process of setting up a tent is like? And then part two of that is, like, what kinds of people do what kinds of jobs for that?
Okay. It depends on the site you're at. Here at Smirkus, we have a pretty basic way of doing everything. So we're really old school, and we have what you call a layout line. And it's basically a line that has certain points marked on it. So instead of using a measuring tape to measure all the points, we actually made a line that has all those points marked out already. So what you'll do is come into an empty field, and you'll survey it in terms of just seeing the level of the field, kind of the condition of the ground. And from that point, you'll make a few measurements, because from the big top comes everything. So that center point that you mark out for the center of the tent is going to dictate where everything else on the lot goes. So you got to make sure that when you make that center point, it's not in the wrong spot. So anyway, we lay it out. We measure everything. We get all the stakes, the side poles, the mass, all that marked out. And then after that, we lay out the plates that we have that will go for the base of each mast and for the guy lines that go to the mast. And once that's there, we get the mast out, we rig up the mast, and we raise everything here by hand. So we have these winches called tier fours, And they're basically hand come-alongs that we raise up the mast with these things called gin poles. This is really obscure, and I know it's probably not the best way to describe it, but basically you have four masts on the ground, and there's a mini mast that goes on top of one of the masts to give a pick point to lift it up. So we raise the mast up. Once the masts are up, we connect the cupola, which is top in Italian, and it's basically the center truss of the big top that we have. And we'll crank that up, and we put measuring tapes on that to know how high we are. And we'll crank that up by hand once again. I've developed a little process here where I use a cowbell and a block to sound off, kind of like a drum beat on a slave ship or something like that. Everyone always says I should get a big drum instead of the block and cowbell.
The Game of Thrones crew. Of
yeah, exactly. So it's,
the opening of Les Mis.
Yeah.
That's a more obscure reference, but
I like
so
that.
How many men does it take, or women? How many people does it take to raise?
So we have one woman on tent crew this year. We've had two in the past, but to raise up the cupola, it's four, one for each mast, and we'll raise up the cupola, and then our style is that the fabric is already connected to the cupola, so it saves us a step, and then we'll pull out the canvas. And our system's really nice because it actually never touches the ground, so we don't have to drag it on the ground and get pinholes and stuff like that. So we'll take it out all by hand. We have 10 people on tent crew, including myself, and we'll unroll the canvas and connect the ratchet straps. And then at that point, it's slightly off of the ground, and we can come inside. And basically, we'll start affixing the poles. And the way we do it is... It's a little funky because we have to lace everything in the air. So we'll put in three poles at the four lace lines where the four pieces of the canvas come together. We'll tension those out, and then we'll actually climb on top of the tent and stitch the tent together while it's up in the air. So that's a job that we reserve for people who ask for it. We don't force that job on anyone. And we've enjoyed really good success in terms of safety because we're really specific about the process. And it saves us, I would say, lacing it in the air as opposed to on the ground saves us a good hour at least for setting it up. So once that's stitched together, then we can put in the rest of the poles and call it guying out, which is just basically making the tent tight. Back in the day, it would be a crew of guys pulling on ropes and lashing it.
Yeah, so some elephants pulling it up too, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, to push up the poles for sure. Yeah, for the quarter poles and stuff. But to actually guy it out, you'd have... like a team of guys pulling on the rope and one guy lashing the rope to the stake. Now we have ratchet straps, which, you know, you'll see them on trucks everywhere. So the mechanical advantage we have now is just levers and ratchets and poles. So it's pretty, you know, it's pretty advanced at this point. So
from you've light up the ground and then when you bring everything on, how long does that take for a tent like Smirkus?
Well, we're pretty proud of our time at Smirkus. A few sites ago, we did an overnight, and we actually had everyone in the company help us. So from when the cupola got lifted up in the ground from the truck to the tent tight and guide out and everything right there, it was 20 minutes. So that's not normal for just the 10 of us. Normally, we get the cupola up, and we can get everything guide out and ready in about 45. So from everything being, if we were to say nothing was in the ground, the stakes weren't in the ground, everything wasn't there, we could come onto a lot and conceivably have the big top up within 2.5-3 hours. So
and you've now worked on sort of the other end of the spectrum as well, doing stuff like Cavalia and Cirque du Soleil, which are these mm-hmm. massive tents. Is the process essentially the same, or is it different for that kind of scale?
The process is more or less the same in terms of, you know, getting the plates in the ground first, getting the guy lines, raising up the bones, being the mass, or in Cavalier's example, they have these arches that go over the outside of the tent. And instead of hand crank winches, we have motors, which are very... finicky.
There's a lot of background noise. Yeah. You hear how happy people are at Smirkus.
It's all right. I think we should still get.
But what was I going to say? So
the differences in
scale. You get the bones, and the scale is basically the same. No matter how big you are, you're still going to need human power to get it out. So there's not like a machine that lays out the canvas and stitches it together. It's all still done by hand. So the scale is just different. Here at Smirkus, we have 10 people. At Cavalia, we'll have 50.
Oh, my God.
So here, the ones we lay out on the ground weigh probably around 1,200 pounds. At Cavalia, they weigh up to 6,000 pounds.
Can you compare the size of the Cavalia tent to something so people can understand just how massive that tent is?
Totally. So to give you an idea of the scale, the Cavalia tent is basically a portable stadium that is a little bigger than a football field. And it has 16 pieces of canvas that get stitched together. And each one of those pieces is almost the size of the Smirkus Big Top.
I remember we drove by the Cavalia tent maybe in Montreal and it was just so big and beautiful, and you're just like, oh my God,
it's like a cathedral. It really is gorgeous. And in terms of the structure, I really enjoy it because it's incredibly secure. You know, they've weathered a lot of storms, and for me, that's when I look at a tent, it's not only is it beautiful, but how secure is it? Mm-hmm. And they have, I think for the Big Top alone, it's like 1500 stakes. So just for the Big Top to anchor it and to have everything secure, it's, you know, more stakes than we'll drive in the entire summer here, you know. So,
and one has to imagine it's probably more dangerous, I'd say, than the average job is, because it includes climbing and lifting and, you know, working with crazy equipment. I'm wondering if you can sort of talk about the structure of the team, because you know you've gone up from being somebody who essentially was an apprentice to just tent crew to now being the tent boss and running these crews of like 50 people. So how does that sort of all structure and lay out?
It was difficult at first. I mean, to begin with, at other shows, we have what we call temps, or we call them casuals, which is a really nice way of saying not so effective. And to tell a 50-year-old man to what to do when you're 26 or something, it's pretty difficult, you know? And that, for me, was the most difficult thing to get beyond. But after that, I really am a big proponent of treating people with respect, learning people's names, and encouraging them to have a good time, because the work in itself is not easy. There's tricks that you can have to lay out canvas and to do certain things, but at the end of the day, it's backbreaking labor. So you can have one of two ways. You can be miserable while you're doing it, and that can affect everyone around you, or you can be happy. And at the end of the day, look at the fruits of your labor, you know, and be really proud. And more often than not, I mean, every site's different. Every crew is going to be different, you know, but when you're working with casuals, it's better to be positive and happy and be respectful. In terms of like the core tent crew guys, like the ones we have here at Smirkus, or the crew that we'll have at Cirque or at Cavalia, it really has to do with culpability and no one kind of hanging back. Everyone has to pull their weight equally, and everyone needs to work their butt off for it to work, you know? So we're really big on razzing people if they don't do their job, you know, and like there's no lack of communication on that front. If someone isn't pulling their weight, they'll be told so, and it'll be nice in the beginning, but if it's not fixed, we get rid of people pretty quick around here, you know.
I think one of the more unsung parts of the job is probably the maintenance of a tent, because you know, the obvious thing is, oh my God, how do you put that up,
right?
But then once it's up, like, shit must happen to it that you can't anticipate. Do you have any like crazy examples of that?
The biggest one was, we were working on a tent, and it was for the stables. It was a very long one. It was about 120 yards long, so a little bigger than a football field in terms of length. And we got it up, and we weren't finished guying it out, making it tight. And someone tried to come in with a man lift, and I told him, hey, not yet. We want to make the tent tight. And he said, oh, come on, you know, it doesn't matter right now. And I said, well, it does to me. So get out of here. Wait until the tent isn't moving anymore, then you can come in. Well, he came in after the tent was tight and hit the wrong button on one of the machines and basically boomed up when he shouldn't have, and poked a hole in the tent, and it literally popped the tent. Like, it was like a gunshot almost, but it was, since the tent was under tension, it pushed until the point where it popped, and the tear was, I always say it in meters, but in feet, it was about a 20-foot tear, and it was like a three-corner tear. So it was like 20 feet straight line, and then like 4 feet in the other corner. And the tent was up, everything was there, and we didn't have the option of taking it down and doing all that. So what we did was we brought the rings down that were lifting the whole canvas, brought them down a little bit so there wasn't a lot of tension. And it was at, of course, 8 o'clock at night when this happened, so we weren't about to fix it. And the next day, we were tasked with fixing it. It took me about 5 hours, but we basically made a platform on a man lift and came underneath to have a a hard surface that I could weld on. And then I came in with a man lift on top of that and welded it together. So the tents nowadays are not made from canvas, even though we still call it canvas. It's made from polyester scrim fabric, kind of like what a ratchet strap is. And then that's coated in PVC. And so when you weld canvas together, you take a hot air gun, basically, and a silicone roller, and you heat it up to about 420 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. And you weld the two pieces. So you melt the two layers of PVC together and press it together. So I basically welded that piece together. And in order to get the two pieces together, because it was such a big tear, I had to weld tabs into the top of the canvas and then use a ratchet strap to actually physically bring the fabric together, because there was just so much weight pulling it apart. So that was probably the most interesting fix that I did. And it was one
of those. Like, sorry.
Yeah. The guy helped me all day. The next day he was there cutting the pieces of vinyl for me and holding it together. And he was really cool about it. Yeah. He was one of those guys who never messed up. And when he did, he really messed up. So, but I think that was a point for me also when I realized that, like, I could fix almost anything, you know, which is pretty cool. But it was, I remember years ago when I was at Big Apple and we were fixing something or other. And my boss, Michael LeClaire, said, oh, just cut it right here and, you know, we can do it. And I was like, I'm not cutting that. You know, like, that's the tent. Like, I can't cut it. I can never get it back the way it was, you know. And he just laughed at me and cut it anyway and showed me you can weld it right back together, you know. And that piece on that tent is actually the strongest part of that tent now, because I put so many layers on it that it's, you know, stronger than it was before. So, yeah.
What would you say the like most rewarding best part of the job is that, you know, you really get off on and makes you want to stay in it?
I mean, there's a lot of little things that add up to the big things, I think. But it is probably just actually physically getting the poles up and getting the tent tight and coming into an empty space and then having something so immediate, you know, come up. So I guess, yeah, like raising the canvas is probably the biggest payoff, I would say. Yeah.
It's definitely the most magical. Like when you watch those time lapse videos and it's just like the canvas is going up. And you're like, oh my God. Well, I guess it is less interesting to be like the PVC coated fabric is going up.
Yeah. It's really not as magical at
all. No.
Yeah.
Are there any tents that you like have seen and really like wish you could be putting up or try to do? Is there like a challenge you've seen, I don't know, from another company somewhere?
Yeah, there's the Peter Pan 360 tent I was kicking around that a company C2 just bought, and I was busy, but I got the call to see if I could help them out. And I was actually supposed to be on the teardown and setup from Dallas for Peter Pan, and they went under. But that tent's really cool because it has, you know, the masts on the outside completely, and there's a few other challenges with like the sidewall and just these little design quirks that everyone who's worked on it hates it and thinks it's the worst. And so now I want to work on it and see if it really is the worst or if people are just, you know, not looking at it the right way. Because most of these tents are made with a pretty specific design in mind, the person who designed it. So that can be really good because they understand the process of installing it, or it can be really bad because they just understand, you know, like the architecture of how it's going to hold and how it's going to, you know, look. And they don't really care about the technicians installing it. So
I guess that's sort of what you're saying is not all tents are created equal as far as that. Is there, who makes the best tent? Like what's the like, you know, the Ferrari of tents?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because Ferrari is actually the name of the company that makes the fabric for almost all the fabric. It's a French company, not an Italian company, but yeah, exactly. I've had the most experience with an Italian company called Canobio, and they're kind of my favorite in terms of their design choices. VSO is the company that Cirque du Soleil uses, and for example, the lacing that connects the two pieces of the top together, or four pieces or however many, they use static climbing rope that's stitched into the canvas, and Canobio uses flat webbing. So the webbing is easier to get through the grommets, it lasts longer, it doesn't swell up as much, so it's little things like that that I really like, and their design is just, I don't know, something really clean about it. I've worked with other Italian companies as well. Atre Alban is one, which is pretty good, but it's just a bit clunky, and Canobio tends to be more elegant in their design. Like they are always kind of looking at ways they can make things more efficient and lighter. Even now, you know, they've been in the business for decades and they're still figuring out new things that they can do. So I really like them, I think. there's just unfortunately no American company that can compare it to anything.
Are there American tent companies?
There are, yeah. There's a lot of American tent companies, and unfortunately they just don't have the technology, the will. I don't know what it is to be able to get the same geometry that you see on, you know, like our tent right there. Like the peak that you have right there is pretty pronounced and really beautiful. And then there's another one for the fairgrounds over there. And they have something similar, but it's still just clunky. Yeah. You know, the angles aren't as slick and elegant. And I don't know why we haven't been able to do that in the States, but for example, like Anchor is a big company here, Anchor Tents, and they make really good frame tents and really good, like, we call them American style, where basically between the two masts, the two top of the king poles, the center poles, is almost straight. Mm-hmm. It's like a straight back. And then they have ones that are like somewhat swooped and have that elegant peak, and they call it their Euro series. So I think they're even aware now that it's, you know, we're behind the ball in terms of that.
Are there any blow up circus tents?
Like inflatable?
Yeah.
Yeah. I myself haven't ever seen one or worked on one, but it's something that, you know, there's air-supported structures, but they're not. The fabric itself is just supported by the difference in the air pressure on the inside versus the outside, and you have to have fans constantly keeping that pressure. Yeah, yeah. But in terms of like a bouncy house type style tent, I haven't seen that.
No, I mean
that.
Like the ones, the air pressure.
Oh, the air-supported
like,
ones. Yeah, yeah. I guess
like orchestras playing those stuff that like doesn't require any like pulling it down of you know, rigging. Away from the ceiling. Yeah,
yeah, the rigging, and also I think those are. You need to, for the rim of them, they need to have like a pretty good foundation and stuff like that. So I think the work to make the pad for that would be more than it'd be worth to travel with.
Right.
But I don't know. I always wonder about that. I've helped take one down, and it's a pretty cool process. I mean, they're engineering wise pretty impressive, but again, like the shape of them is kind of like, it's a dome. Yeah.
That's right. You just recently bought your own circus tent.
I did. I bought it from an old school tent guy. It's kind of the best way to get into it, I think. Eric Jaeger, is kind of the man in the industry, in the States. He's worked on every tent there is. And, he posted it for sale. I contacted him and we worked out a deal. And so a few years ago, I was really hoping I could work with him at some point. And now I'm basically, you know, partnered with him, which is pretty incredible. But yeah, I bought my own tent. It's a 24 meter round. So I guess in American talk, that's about an 80 round, and it has two masts, or king poles is what we call the center pieces, the center truss. And then the top, the cupola, it's basically the same as a Smirkus tent, actually. If you look at the dimensions, it's 80 round and it's about 30 feet up in the air is the top of the truss. But it's really elegant, a really beautiful looking tent. It's pretty simple in the design. It's a Kenobio tent, of course. And I named it after my mother and my grandmother and my great grandmother.
They all have the name Charlotte?
Yep. Yeah, it's a family name. Oh. So yeah, I named it Charlotte. And it's very natural. It seems like it was a Charlotte all along.
Yes.
So,
it's really like a beautiful tent. It's red and white and has this great like old school, I mean, this is like a really good way, like Swiss vibe to the way it looks.
Yeah.
Just throwing it out there, if people are interested in like renting tents, like how would they go about that? Or
they can
you?
Contact me directly. I don't have a website. I don't have anything. I'm a sole proprietor. I started another business this year and it didn't have it in me to start another one. So I'm just I actually started a crewing company with two of my friends from Cirque du Soleil. So Cirque du Soleil has gone through a bunch of different changes, and basically they abolished their fly-in department. And the fly-in department basically provided auxiliary support for the moves. And we all kind of got casually fired in a way, you know, not fired directly, but say, oh, we might not call you anymore. Okay. But we knew that the shows would still need a specialized labor force. So we got together, we got our insurance, we did everything. And now we're staffing all the North American shows with tents right now for all of their transfers. So yeah, you can check out that website at crewthat.com. Crewthat. So that's us. And we do not only cirque gigs, but we also do overhire for special rigging projects. We've done scaffolding. We've done all sorts of stuff for that as well. So it's kind of this tent thing is also like it happened and then through that happened. And so I am, you know, I've got my hands in a lot of projects. And so for if anyone is interested in renting out the tent, they can contact me directly at nat.tentrental@gmail.com. So it's real high class right there.
And if you're not sure, definitely email Nat at least just to see the photos of this tent. Yeah. Like that in and of itself is worth the email.
Yeah.
Another thing that we've sort of talked about in other podcasts, and this is sort of a bigger like industry question, is that we found that lots of circus shows that are going to cities are built for prosceniums, and that the tented shows, but also because of animal rights regulations mm-hmm. and the lack of free like land space, tend to go into more rural locations and more rural cities. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed like a change in the places that you've been sent to and that you're going like over your career?
It depends on the show. I mean, Cavalia, for their space, is often in undeveloped land that they strike a deal where they level the land and kind of improve it, and that's how they kind of get the contract to it. Cirque has tried 100% of the time to stay where they're at, and in my experience they've been in the same kind of spots. Most often stadium parking lots is where they end up, and they try to be as close to highways. Cavalia especially, they won't set up unless it's right next to a freeway, because they want
the tent.
That's it, the curb appeal. So I haven't noticed in my time. I've been working at Cirque. I worked at Cirque starting in 2009, so it's been a while, and they're pretty much in the same spot still. So I haven't noticed a change in the tent lots. I mean, the space requirement is such that their hands are kind of tied in a lot of ways, because, you know, if they go too rural, then they don't have the same exposure, and people, you know, don't want to travel as much. And there's also, I think, an esteem thing too. Like, the closer you are to the city, like, the more, you know, mm-hmm. the more claim
prestigious and like, yeah, that's yeah. true. The more you can charge for a ticket.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, but, you know, on the other end of that, Cavalia was just in Chicago on Lakeshore Drive, and one of the most like high traffic areas. Mm-hmm. And they didn't do so well because the show didn't appeal to the metropolitan crowd.
Right.
We had people coming in from Indiana and Minnesota and stuff like that to see the show. People who are horse people, you right. know. And we went to middle of nowhere in Canada, trying to remember the name of the place now. But we slayed it. We killed it because everyone loves horses, right. you know. Mississauga, I think. But yeah, it's just...
Well, when Curious, mm-hmm. the Cirque du Soleil yep. show, was on Randall's Island, and it didn't...
Yeah.
Didn't do very well. It's hard to get to. It's like so close, but it's hard.
Yeah. So the one thing that I have noticed with Cirque especially is they've been changing their sites based on what they can rent them for. So they're in Randall's Island because it was cheaper to be there. They had in the past been in Queens, and they did pretty well there.
At City Field?
Yep. Yeah. City Field, exactly. So they did really well there because the subway was right there, and people know the area. You know, it's right by LaGuardia and stuff. And I think they've raised the price on them, so they didn't go there anymore. So, yeah.
Yeah, basic capitalism principles
totally.
for something like Cirque these days.
Yeah.
So what would you say to somebody who's like, oh my God, that sounds like so much fun. Like, I want to do that. Like, what is the first step into like trying to get into that world?
Stay in school. And no, I'm just kidding. The first step to get into the world would be to get in with a company like Circus Mercus. Honestly, if you are interested in working with tents specifically, here at Mercus, we have the best of all worlds. We upgraded our kit to have three Kenobio tents, one big top, two satellite tents, and those are some of the top tier type of tents. And the way we work here is, in the circus world, a good mix of old school and new school. So if you want to try it out and see if you like the work, here's a good place to start. It's pretty much impossible to get yourself in at the ground level at another show like Cirque du Soleil or even Cavalia unless you know someone, and the best way to know someone is by working with them. So yeah, I would say send your application to Circus Mercus, and maybe we'll chat.
Nice. I don't want to hold you for too long, because I know you have a meeting about loading this tent out in like 4 hours from now. But we do always ask our guests the final three questions. Mm-hmm. The first of which is, has there been a piece of advice, like good or terrible, that somebody in your life has given you that has stuck with you?
Yeah. My boss, my first boss, I worked landscaping for my first job when I was just 12 years old, almost still 11. And his name was Kenny Woodman. And he had a tree company, and he did it the old school way. So we'd climb and you know, drop trees from the top down, dropping them, rigging and all that stuff. So I did all the rigging I have now. I learned when I was like 12, you know, and promptly forgot it because I was a snot-nosed kid. But he told me anything worth doing is worth doing right. You know, and that's like a really basic thing. But what he did for me was really instill in me a strong work ethic. And for him, you know, it was just the two of us. It wasn't a big company. So we'd take down trees, just this 12-year-old kid and this 30-year-old guy. And it wasn't by crane or by anything like that. It was by using your brain, looking at the lay of the land and never doing anything the exact same twice because it doesn't warrant being done twice. So, and always just being present. And he always would give me crap and say, know your vectors. And I didn't know what the hell a vector was. You know, I still don't really, but just kind of like keep your head, you know, yeah, we're cutting grass all day, but pay attention to what the heck you're doing. Right. You know, it may be like hard work, but like be present in that hard work, you know? So
the second question, and this is, you know, usually more focused towards circus performers and directors, mm-hmm. but I'd be super curious to know what you think of it, which, you know, we try to skew more towards people who are, again, trying to learn about the industry. Mm-hmm. Is there a show or like a movie or a book or something that was like super influential on you that you think people should like see or experience? Mm.
Big Apple Circus. Get out and see it, I think.
The new one.
Yeah, the new one, the reboot. Yeah, yeah. So get out and see them. Give them another chance, I think. They're, you know, people around, you know, when I say that I work at the circus, they say, oh, the circus is dead. The circus has closed down. And, you know, and Ringling is such a small part of the community that I don't think people understand. And with Big Apple. Yeah. And so Big Apple is great because it's that intimate one ring European style that is really classic, you know, and it's, you know, if you want a taste of that, you should check that out. I would say Big Apple would be the biggest one because that's still the first one I saw. So, you know. And Circus in America is a book. It's just a really basic book, but it is like nice, thick, has good pictures, and it's like an old book. It's not like gonna wow you at all, but Circus in America has some really good history about, you know, the tented show and moving. Probably did.
We'll point it out later.
And our last question is, who do you think we should have on the podcast?
Ooh, who do I think you should have on the podcast? Well, shucks. I mean, if you wanted to go the similar route in terms of, you know, operational ends of things, I would say Felipe Terran, who is the operational guy at Big Apple. He's mm-hmm. the guy who's very much behind the scenes, doesn't want to be interviewed, doesn't want any of that. He would be great because he's seen so much. But if not him, then Tom Larson is an incredible person to interview.
He was their general manager, right? Yep. Big Apple, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he left and came back a few times. And he, you know, he was an old tent guy and he got up and he worked at Cirque for a little bit. And he's just got a really good perspective on things, and he's really knowledgeable about all aspects of it. So yeah, Tom Larson would be another good one, I would say.
Oh, great. Well, Matt, thank you so much for doing the podcast. This has for sure been one of my favorite interviews.
Yeah.
And I think also one of the most original ones.
We're sitting on the Circus Mercus lot. Josh's favorite thing in the world.
I know, right?
All right, good luck with Loadout tonight.
Thank you, sir.
That was our interview with Nat Brown.
If you like our podcast in this episode, make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us, rate us on iTunes, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Thanks for listening.
Have a great week, everybody.